We are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
50 years ago, April 4th, 1967, 1 year to the day before he was assassinated, in the now legendary Riverside Church speech, Dr. Martin Luther King described the nightmare to come, quote, "A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death." My guess is that when Dr. King was worried about that situation, it's gotten a lot worse. I can't imagine Dr. King and our current president agreeing on anything. Millions of Americans today are still committed, perhaps more than ever, because of the severe challenges we face to achieving, to striving for Martin Luther King's dream, which did include the message of that speech that day. It was very, very different from his boxed-in civil rights image that most people had and were comfortable with. And this went beyond the bounds of the narrow civil rights focus, which was defined as acceptable by white liberal allies. The speech was called Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break the Silence. It was about the deep worldwide connection that exists among poor people, including the people of Vietnam and America. People who were our official enemies in Vietnam, he, Martin Luther King, considered to be among the oppressed people of the world by the world's greatest purveyor of violence, those are his words, the United States. Well, our guest today, Eric Tang, has an article in The Nation magazine in which he observes that since MLK's time, quote, "a liberal civil rights agenda that has failed to root out deep systemic racial injustices while championing superficial racial equality under law." Eric Tang is associate professor of Black Studies at the University of Texas at Austin, which I have heard described as a blueberry floating in tomato soup, the one liberal area of Texas in the entire state. He is a visiting scholar at the City University of New York, and he's author of Unsettled: Cambodian Refugees in the New York City Hyper Ghetto. Well, thanks so much for being with us, Eric Tang. And I know we have about, half an hour. A nation's memory, the pictures of our past that we tell ourselves and believe in, are often twisted over time to suit semi-official myth. Of course, I've been amazed at the sanitizing and erasure of the real Martin Luther King we've seen in recent decades. I was alive and inspired very much by Dr. King, among many others in the 60s, and the image with which we are presented today varies greatly from what I experienced about the man and his values. Suffice it to say, he was not a Republican. Without question, Martin Luther King leaned left. That's pretty much washed away in today's memory. To me, the Riverside Church speech was extremely important in his overall message and work. Yet today it seems pretty much buried behind the safe myth we teach our school children. I've always seen 1967 as a real turning point in American history, a tipping point, if you will. Opposition to the war shifted from being a small minority, and it started to shift that year, I think, to the majority. Who was the audience that Martin Luther King was speaking to at that Riverside speech, April 4th, 1967? Who was sitting there in the Riverside Church?
Well, he was speaking primarily to
fellow clergy who had come out against the war and had passed a resolution against the war, which they desperately wanted Dr. King to sign on to. And it should be made clear that this wasn't the first time he had publicly come out against the war, but it was his definitive break from the Johnson administration. He took his hardest line against the kind of liberalism that the Johnson administration engaged in and authorized. And that liberalism was one that, thought it could simultaneously wage a racist and depraved war in Vietnam while championing racial justice at home.
Yeah.
And Martin Luther King knew as the war was escalating and as U.S. crimes in Vietnam and the rest of Southeast Asia continued to escalate, that there was just no way this administration was going to take seriously the cause of racial justice beyond civil rights protections so long as it was engaged in such depraved acts in Vietnam.
Right.
And so the audience was primarily clergy who had, again, come out against the war, and obviously, you know, Harlem residents, those who, you know, are from the surrounding Harlem community in which Riverside Church is based.
Right, right. It is, sort of upstate New York almost. It's way above 125th Street, I think, somewhere up there in the Riverside area. We're talking about Martin Luther King's speech of 50 years ago, the famous or infamous, depending on how you look at it, Riverside speech. You write that the Riverside speech was his declaration of no confidence in the nation's leading liberals, particularly the Johnson administration. Now, Johnson, I think, is still seen as a traditional liberal. He tried to model a lot of his domestic policies on Franklin Delano Roosevelt, which is, I think, sort of defines liberalism. But Dr. King, in that speech, had the audacity to say that LBJ and the liberals in power were not really invested in full equality for African Americans. You write that the clearest evidence of this was their murderous foray into Vietnam. How did our war against the people of Vietnam reflect the reality of white liberal America's sentiments on and commitment to achieving civil rights?
So this isn't your average kind of anti-war speech made by someone who is, you know, an avowed nonviolent leader. You know, we would expect Martin Luther King, given his position on nonviolence, to come out against any war. But what it really was is an opportunity for him to talk about the domestic front and the international front as one, to talk about what we describe as liberal warfare as one and the same. And what he was noticing was that as the war escalated, the domestic program, the war on poverty, was being retrenched.
Yes.
And he said to himself, you know, this isn't a coincidence, and it's also not just about the bottom line, like money going from one thing to the next. What it really reflects is a deeper commitment that the liberals, the Johnson administration in particular, have to warfare, to resolving conflicts through violence.
Yes.
And he says to himself, there's no way that this logic can leave the U.S. ghetto untouched. Does that make sense? That eventually this logic will dictate how the liberals treat urban black America. And he was right. He was right, because it was these very liberals who, in the coming years, would be the chief architects behind law and order policies, this war against crime, which was really a war against the poor.
Yes.
It was these liberals, beginning with Johnson and the Safe Street Acts, that led us into this age of mass incarceration.
Yes. Yeah, the war on drugs. I mean, that's been just an incredible tragedy, and has only, been extremely profitable for those who profit from it. And, the image of liberalism, nice people, but don't rock the boat. I remember so well during demonstrations against the war that there was, some tension between liberals and what were then called radicals about what it was really about. I mean, some the liberals considered it, oh, it was well-intentioned, the war in Vietnam. I think Martin Luther King speaks to this quite a bit, that it wasn't well-intentioned, that liberalism, you know, including the warlike attitude. I mean, even recently, Hillary Clinton was very, very hawkish. And how people could describe her as a liberal, I never really understood. I suppose socially, culturally, she was. But it's not really getting... I mean, Martin Luther King was, what if anybody knows anything about him, was all about fairness and justice, no matter what your skin color. And this form of liberalism just, it didn't allow for that. You had to get to the roots of it, and that's what he did, and I think that bothered a lot of people. And certainly in the late 50s and early 60s, most of America was horrified to watch on TV the blatant, overt brutality of officially sanctioned, usually police violence against African Americans in the South. We heard the names Bull Connor, Orville Faubus, George Wallace. They were the obvious bad guys. But traditional Southern, you know, Jim Crow laws and blatant racism was far from the whole picture. You write that Dr. King, in that Riverside speech, dared to look beyond the obvious and put what he called America's true values under a microscope. I wonder if you could say more. What true values was he talking about that concerned him so greatly?
So King was convinced by, I would say, 1966, that the Civil Rights legislation of 64, the Voting Rights Act of 65, that these were not going to be nearly enough to bring about full equality for African Americans. And he lays out this argument actually more carefully in his book, you know, Community or Chaos, mm-hmm. which comes out, you know, a few months after this Riverside Church speech. This argument that these civil rights protections were important, no doubt, but they were not going to deliver on full equality. And the question was whether or not liberals like or exemplified by the Johnson administration were actually invested in full equality, meaning were they really invested in doing the things that needed to be done to redress, you know, centuries of African-American oppression? Or were they simply interested in telling the South what it could no longer do to African-Americans? Right. You get the difference? So, like, there are protections which say, okay, you can no longer discriminate, and the state will no longer uphold your state-sanctioned discrimination.
Right.
But that is very distinct from engaging in policies and practices of redress that try to restore in some measure, or build in some measure, I should say, towards African-American equality. And he notices that the liberals who had co-signed the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65 were not really going to move on that piece, that they were more than comfortable with allowing economic and social inequality to persist in the urban North.
Yes. Yes.
Even as they signed on legislation which denied the South the ability to discriminate against African Americans via Jim Crow laws.
Well,
and then he sees Vietnam and he says, I'm certain of it now. I'm certain of it because these liberals are just too wedded to inequality and to resolving, you know, our most intractable social problems through violence and through state repression, I should say.
And jumping ahead 50 years, you know, you see the split within the Democratic Party between those who were fine with corporate rule and just, you know, keeping everything in control, the people who were profiting from the war industries, you know, just going on and on. That was the Hillary Clinton wing, obviously. And there was the Bernie Sanders wing, which to me was far more authentic. And I can't help but see, not exactly parallels, but something similar about getting to the roots of the issues. That just, you know, keeping things as they are, business as usual. I mean, a lot of us out in the streets back in the late 60s, you know, when we heard the phrase, you got to keep business as usual, it kind of, we bristled at that. And I think Martin Luther King certainly did that too. Now, certainly the liberal establishment at the time was not real pleased with Dr. King connecting civil rights with American foreign policy. I remember liberal colleagues being concerned that Dr. King was, quote, hurting the cause of his people. Notice that his people, right? By veering off from civil rights as narrowly defined as you write, President Lyndon Johnson disinvited King to the White House, severing his ties with the civil rights icon. This break, you say, has defined the past 50 years of American liberalism. Please explain what you mean by that.
Well, King presented us with a choice that night. You know, he said, we're going to go down this path of wars of imperialism, state repression at home, corporate rule, as you suggest, although the term wasn't in play back then, 50 years ago.
Yeah, it wasn't.
But the antecedents certainly were. Or are we going to, you know, go down a different road, which is defined by true equality that's rooted in taking redressive action for African Americans and others who have been historically oppressed, building real programs that not only lift people out of poverty, but give them an opportunity at a livable wage, and that are rooted in principles of love, as he states, as opposed to resolving conflict through violence. And it's clear which road the Democratic Party has taken over the past 50 years. So when I write that this split with Johnson has defined the past 50 years of liberalism, it's because Johnson made a choice, which was to dismiss, to repudiate King after the speech at Riverside. And the dominant wing of the Democratic Party, those liberals, did as well. And so this split has in many ways defined the road taken and not taken by the Democratic Party over the past five decades.
And I think, just from my personal observation and participation, I think we would have been better off had we spoken to the roots, you know, and followed what Dr. King and others, you know, were talking about, that, you know, being a colonial power was the people in Vietnam, you know, I suppose the liberals could have said, you know, just accept the government that we say is best for you. You know, that seems it seems like a common theme among so many establishment liberals, which, again, wasn't a phrase back then, that just, you know, we know what's best for you. And Martin Luther King called that deadly Western arrogance that has poisoned the international atmosphere for so long.
Yeah, and, you know, the thing about the speech, too, is that he leaves no question about his anti-imperialist leanings. I mean, if anyone questioned whether or not he was an anti-imperialist before that speech at Riverside, he put those questions to rest on that evening 50 years ago. He lays out a clear case for how the Vietnamese rightly fought against French colonialism.
Yes.
How it rightly defeated French colonialism. Mm-hmm. And how the United States was the main international force encouraging the French to get back in it and not give up, even after the French's disastrous defeat in Dien Bien Phu in 1954. Finally, the United States realizes there's no way the French are going to get back in, so that's when it begins its own buildup in the region, which eventually leads to a full-scale invasion of South Vietnam and the beginning of the so-called Vietnam War, what we call the Vietnam War.
What they call the American War.
What they call the American War, exactly. And King takes a significant amount of time during that speech to take us through exactly where we had intervened in the self-determination of another country.
Mm-hmm.
Another country that, after it had successfully ousted its European aggressors, was resolved, wanted to pursue a peaceful resolution to national reunification, and we thwarted that peaceful effort.
There was supposed to be an election in 1956, and as obviously you know, we didn't allow that to happen because Ho Chi Minh would have won.
Yes. And so he takes us through all of this in a way that you would not expect from, you know, this civil rights icon who was supposed to stay in his lane, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so this is where your opening point about the way in which his legacy and his politics have been sanitized and obscured and just outright misrepresented is so true. Like, there is a very clear, unambiguous anti-imperialist statement he's making in this speech, which those who have, you know, sought to celebrate him in the name of liberalism consistently deny,
yes,
cover up, and refuse to acknowledge.
Yes, they do. They want to keep him safe, you know, don't upset the apple cart. Well, that speech certainly upset the apple cart. If you just tuned in to Keeping Democracy Alive, Bert Cohen here. Our guest today is Eric Tang, who's written an article. He's an associate professor of Black Studies, University of Texas in Austin. Brave man being in Texas. And we're talking about Martin Luther King's Riverside speech, which came 1 year to the day before he was assassinated. He upset a lot of people in that speech. Again, in that speech, King noted that as military spending increased, which it did, the funding for domestic needs suffered. As you quote him, Dr. King said, "When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people," end of quote, as demonstrated by Johnson's war in Vietnam, "then such values would no doubt guide the liberals' treatment of the black community at home," King reasoned. He was certainly right. And what happened to those liberals who supported civil rights legislation and continuing to wage the war in Vietnam? How did this group perhaps unwittingly help to create the destructive war on drugs and today's horrible mass incarceration that we talked about a few minutes ago? What's their part in it? And, you know, why? It just baffles me why we couldn't see what was going on. I mean, in the 1950s, when I was growing up, I always thought America would be against colonialism. That's how we were founded. And I was shocked, like a lot of people my age, us boomers, that we were on the side of the bad guys there. So how did, you know, the liberals who supported civil rights legislation for those other people down south and continuing to wage war in Vietnam, how did they exacerbate a lot of the problems that Dr. King was really talking about?
Well, as I mentioned in the article, Dr. King understood by 1966-67 that the liberals who had supported the Civil Rights Act were more invested in disassociating themselves with the cruel optics of the Deep South, right? The ugliness right. of that form of violence,
right.
You know, typified by Bull Connor mm-hmm. and images of, you know, of lynching.
The fire hoses, yeah.
And firebombing of black churches. So they wanted to clearly disassociate themselves with that. And they knew they had no choice but to, because the Civil Rights Act was effective in splitting the Democratic Party along those lines during the early to mid-1960s. And that's, you know, that's its legacy, being able to push, you know, Kennedy and Johnson to ultimately break with Southern Democrats. So once that's done, the question remains, what about equality? Are these liberals invested in full equality for African Americans, which is a different story? And they're not. They're not invested in it. They don't trust that African Americans are their equals. And King makes this argument again rather forcefully in his last book. And he notices that they are more invested in carrying out warfare than they are in equality. This is clearly, again, the situation in Vietnam, but you also see the antecedents of this in terms of Johnson's own domestic policy. So much is made of his Great Society programs, his
right.
anti-poverty programs.
Right.
But coterminous with those pieces of, you know, legislation which authorized anti-poverty were other pieces of legislation which authorized, you know, law and order and policing of the poor, particularly African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
This dates back to the Kennedy administration, and it culminates in the signing of the 1968 Safe Streets Act. There's a historian at Harvard who's written a brilliant book about, you know, giving the political history of the Safe Streets Act. Her name is Elizabeth Hinton, and the book is called From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, The Makings of Mass Incarceration. And here we see that, again, parallel to the Great Society programs, the anti-poverty programs, are a host of, you know, law and order programs that seek to fund law enforcement, the criminal justice system in general, that eventually call for the militarization of the police after the urban unrest of 1967.
Right.
So there's a form of liberal warfare taking place at the same time as these so-called anti-poverty programs. And in the end, these law and order policies and practices far, far exceed the anti-poverty programs. They outrun them. They're more heavily funded. And this leads us directly into, again, the age of mass incarceration. And it's the liberals who are doing this. Not, you know, of course, Nixon and Reagan also you know, augment these programs, but the architects are liberals.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, just it does seem the more we talk about it, that it's about respecting other people. You know, it's not just tolerating, you know, keeping the wealthy white Wall Street control mechanism in place, unaffected, and just cleaning up the brutal optics, as you describe. You know, there's that. But it seems like what King was trying to get to was the sense that, yeah, we are the policemen of the world, that we should be ruling, that we, you know, white Americans have a right to rule the world. And it seems like that is still going on. And I know you only have a couple more minutes. In that speech, Dr. King warned that, quote, if America's soul becomes totally poisoned, part of the autopsy must read Vietnam, end of quote. It seems since then America has very strenuously erased the lessons of Vietnam, very strenuously. I mean, we refuse to get it. With the Soviet Union long gone, America is the only superpower militarily. What about our real strength in the world today? We used to have our strength in our moral leadership. At least that's what I thought. We may not yet be calling for an autopsy, but is our arrogant, continued racist militarism, as King saw it, still killing us, perhaps a bit more slowly than he had figured?
Yes, there's racist militarism, but there's also extreme materialism, which he calls out in the speech as well. And this is the other thing that needs to be highlighted. You know, when he talks about America's soul, he is talking about, you know, the violence perpetrated, you know, at home and abroad, but he's also talking about how we're a society that's moving increasingly and rapidly towards extreme materialism.
Yes.
Looking back over the course of 50 years, one would have to say he was absolutely right. He's absolutely right. But there's a moment in 1967 where he says, we don't have to go down this road.
Mm.
In 2017, we're like, we're in it. We're done. There's no question that, you know, so much of who we are, how this country is defined is, you know, is in extreme materialism, extreme gaps,
yes.
You know, disparities in income and wealth. But back in 67, he was saying to us, it doesn't have to be this way.
Yes.
There's still an opportunity.
Yes.
And so he invokes America's soul to say, listen, this is what's at stake. It's not just about, you know, whether or not you know, your taxes are going to be raised because we need to fund wars or anti-poverty programs. He's really asking, who are we going to be in 50 years if we continue along this road?
Mm.
And that's what's so, on the one hand, brilliant but also haunting about the speech is that he so clearly saw what was going to happen. And you can almost kind of get off your list as you're reading the speech or listening to it 50 years later. Yes, he was right about this. Yep, he was right about that. We did become a society of not just that's addicted to warfare, but also extreme materialism.
Extreme materialism.
And this was, again, an astounding thing to hear from King, who everyone just wanted as their, you know, cherished civil rights leaders who would talk about the cruelties of the Deep South.
Yeah, and it was a lot more than that. And he knew it, and the gap, I mean, I remember in the 50s and 60s, we had something called a middle class. We really did. And now, you know, the wage gap, the income gap is astounding. And that is part of the picture. You know, if we're not, you know, if America is not achieving itself in terms of what our founders, at least some of them anyway, saw as a land of liberty where people could participate and respect other people, Boy, we may be the strongest militarily, but wow, we have really, really weakened ourselves, I think. And the problems go on, as you said. I mean, he certainly had a vision. I want to thank you so much for being with us, Professor Tang, today, Eric Tang. I don't know if people want to follow your stuff. Any particular website you can point them to?
Sure. They could follow unsettledcity.com.
Yeah. It certainly is unsettledcity.com these days. Well, now we're going to spend the rest of the program listening to a good bit of that speech. Thank you so much, Professor Tang, for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
All right. And this is the actual speech itself, not the entire thing, but a good portion of it. And listen for yourself. Listen closely if you can. And try to imagine how people that wanted Dr. King to be, you know, just, you know, keeping his place, as it were, just talking about the bad guys in the evil South. Here's Dr. Martin Luther King from that Riverside speech, April 4th, 50 years ago.
Over the past 2 years, as I have moved to break the betrayal of my own silences and to speak from the burnings of my own heart, as I have called for radical departures from the destruction of Vietnam, many persons have questioned me about the wisdom of my path. At the heart of their concerns, this query has often loomed large and loud. Why are you speaking about the war, Dr. King? Why are you joining the voices of dissent? Peace and civil rights don't mix, they say. Aren't you hurting the cause of your people, they ask. And when I hear them, though I often understand the source of their concern, I'm nevertheless greatly saddened, for such questions mean that the inquirers have not really known me, my commitment or my calling. Indeed, their questions suggest that they do not know the world in which they live. In the light of such tragic misunderstanding, I deem it of signal importance to try to state clearly, and I trust concisely, why I believe that the path from Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, the church in Montgomery, Alabama, where I began my pastorate, leads clearly to this sanctuary tonight. I come to this platform tonight to make a passionate plea to my beloved nation. This speech is not addressed to Hanoi or to the National Liberation Front. It is not addressed to China or to Russia. Nor is it an attempt to overlook the ambiguity of the total situation and the need for a collective solution to the tragedy of Vietnam. Neither is it an attempt to make North Vietnam or the National Liberation Front paragons of virtue, nor to overlook the role they must play in the successful resolution of the problem. While they both may have justifiable reasons to be suspicious of the good faith of the United States, life and history give eloquent testimony to the fact that conflicts are never resolved without trustful give and take on both sides. Tonight, however, I wish not to speak with Hanoi and the National Liberation Front, but rather to my fellow Americans. That is, at the outset, a very obvious and almost facile connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. There were experiments, hopes, new beginnings. Then came the build-up in Vietnam, and I watched this program broken and eviscerated, as if it was some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor so long as adventures like Vietnam continue to draw men and skills and money like some demonic destructive suction tube. So I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and to attack it as such. Perhaps a more tragic recognition of reality took place when it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and to die in extraordinarily high proportions relative to the rest of the population. We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by our society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Holland. And so we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schools. And so we watch them in brutal solidarity, burning the huts of a poor village. But we realize that they would hardly live on the same block in Chicago. I could not be silent in the face of such cruel manipulation of the poor. My third reason moves to an even deeper level of awareness, for it grows out of my experience in the ghettos of the North over the last 3 years, especially the last three summers. As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. For the sake of those boys, for the sake of this government, for the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence, I cannot be silent. For those who ask the question, aren't you a civil rights leader? And thereby mean to exclude me from the movement for peace, I have this further answer. In 1957, when a group of us formed the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, we chose as our motto to save the soul of America. We were convinced that we could not limit our vision to certain rights for black people, but instead affirmed the conviction that America would never be free or saved from itself until the descendants of its slaves were loosed completely from the shackles they still wear. In a way, we were agreeing with Langston Hughes, that black Bart of Harlem, who had written earlier, "Oh, yes, I say it plain. America never was America to me, and yet I swear this oath, America will be." Now it should be incandescently clear that no one who has any concern for the integrity and life of America today can ignore the present war. If America's soul becomes totally poisoned, part of the autopsy must read Vietnam. It can never be saved so long as it destroys the deepest hopes of men the world over. So it is that those of us who are yet determined that America will be are led down the path of protest and dissent working for the health of our land. As if the weight of such a commitment to the life and health of America were not enough, another burden of responsibility was placed upon me in 1954. And I cannot forget that the Nobel Peace Prize was also a commission to work harder than I had ever worked before for the brotherhood of man. This is a calling that takes me beyond national allegiances. But even if it were not present, I would yet have to live with the meaning of my commitment to the ministry of Jesus Christ. To me, the relationship of this ministry to the making of peace is so obvious that I sometimes marvel at those who ask me why I am speaking against the war. Could it be that they do not know that the good news was meant for all men, for communists and capitalists, for their children and ours, for black and for white, for revolutionary and conservative? Have they forgotten that my ministry is in obedience to the one who loved his enemies so fully that he died for them? What then can I say to the Viet Cong, or to Castro, or to Mao as a faithful minister of this one? Can I threaten them with death, or must I not share with them my life? And finally, as I try to explain for you and for myself the road that leads from Montgomery to this place, I would have offered all that was most valid if I simply said that I must be true to my conviction that I share with all men the calling to be a son of the living God. Beyond the calling of race, a nation, a creed, is this vocation of sonship and brotherhood. Because I believe that the Father is deeply concerned, especially for his suffering and helpless and outcast children, I come tonight to speak for them. This I believe to be the privilege and the burden of all of us who deem ourselves bound by allegiances and loyalties, which are broader and deeper than nationalism, and which go beyond our nation's self-defined goals and positions. We are called to speak for the weak, for the voiceless, for the victims of our nation, and for those it calls enemy. For no document from human hands can make these humans any less our brothers. And as I ponder the madness of Vietnam, and search within myself for ways to understand and respond in compassion, my mind goes constantly to the people of that peninsula. I speak now not of the soldiers of each side, not of the ideologies of the Liberation Front, not of the hunter inside gone, but simply of the people who have been living under the curse of war for almost three continuous decades now. I think of them, too, because it is clear to me that there will be no meaningful solution there until some attempt is made to know them and hear their broken cries. They must see Americans as strange liberators. The Vietnamese people proclaimed their own independence in 1945 after a combined French and Japanese occupation and before the Communist Revolution in China. They were led by Ho Chi Minh. Even though they quoted the American Declaration of Independence in their own document of freedom, we refused to recognize them. Instead, we decided to support France in its reconquest of a former colony. Our government felt then that the Vietnamese people were not ready for independence, and we again fell victim to the deadly Western arrogance that has poisoned the international atmosphere for so long. With that tragic decision, we rejected a revolutionary government seeking self-determination. and a government that had been established not by China, for whom the Vietnamese have no great love, but by clearly indigenous forces that included some communists. For the peasants, this new government meant real land reform, one of the most important needs in their lives. For 9 years following 1945, we denied the people of Vietnam the right of independence. For 9 years, we vigorously supported the French in their abortive effort to recolonize Vietnam. Before the end of the war, we were meeting 80% of the French war cost. Even before the French were defeated at Dien Bien Phu, they began to despair of their reckless action, but we did not. We encouraged them with our huge financial and military supplies to continue the war even after they had lost the will. Soon we would be paying almost the full cost of this tragic attempt at recolonization. After the French were defeated, it looked as if independence and land reform would come again through the Geneva Agreement. But instead, there came the United States, determined that Ho should not unify the temporarily divided nation. And the peasants watched again as we supported one of the most vicious modern dictators, our chosen man, Premier Diem. The peasants watched and cringed as Diem ruthlessly rooted out all opposition, supported their extortionist landlords, and refused even to discuss reunification with the North. The peasants watched as all this was presided over by United States influence, and then by increasing numbers of United States troops who came to help quell the insurgency that Diem's methods had aroused. When Diem was overthrown, they may have been happy, but the long line of military dictators seemed to offer no real change, especially in terms of their need for land and peace. The only change came from America, as we increased our troop commitments in support of governments which were singularly corrupt, inept, and without popular support. All the while, the people read our leaflets and received irregular promises of peace and democracy and land reform. Now they languish under our bombs and consider us not their fellow Vietnamese, the real enemy. They move sadly and apathetically as we herd them off the land of their fathers into concentration camps where minimal social needs are rarely met. They know they must move on or be destroyed by our bombs. So they go, primarily women and children and the aged. They watch as we poison their water, as we kill 1 million acres of their crops. They must weep as the bulldozers roll through their areas preparing to destroy the precious trees. They wandered into the hospitals with at least 20 casualties from American firepower for one Viet Cong inflicted injury. So far, we may have killed 1 million of them, mostly children. They wander into the towns and see thousands of the children, homeless, without clothes, running in packs on the streets like animals. They see the children degraded by our soldiers as they beg for food. They see the children selling their sisters to our soldiers, soliciting for their mothers. What do the peasants think as we ally ourselves with the landlords and as we refuse to put any action into our many words concerning land reform? What do they think as we test out our latest weapons on them, just as the Germans tested out new medicine and new tortures in the concentration camps of Europe? Where are the roots of the independent Vietnam we claim to be building? Is it among these voiceless ones? We have destroyed their two most cherished institutions, the family, and the village. We have destroyed their land and their crops. We have cooperated in the crushing of the nation's only non-communist revolutionary political force, the Unified Buddhist Church. We have supported the enemies of the peasants of Saigon. We have corrupted their women and children and killed their men. Now there is little left to build on save bitterness. What of the National Liberation Front? That strangely anonymous group we call VC or Communists. What must they think of the United States of America when they realize that we permitted the repression and cruelty of DM, which helped to bring them into being as a resistance group in the South? What do they think of our condoning the violence, which led to their own taking up of arms? How can they believe in our integrity when now we speak of aggression from the North as if there were nothing more essential to the war? How can they trust us when now we charge them with violence after the murderous reign of DM, and charge them with violence while we pour every new weapon of death into their land? Surely we must understand their feelings, even if we do not condone their actions. Surely we must see that the men we supported pressed them to their violence. Surely we must see that our own computerized plans of destruction simply dwarf their greatest acts. How do they judge us when our officials know that their membership is less than 25% communist and yet insist on giving them the blanket name? What must they be thinking when they know that we are aware of their control of major sections of Vietnam, and yet we appear ready to allow national elections in which this highly organized political parallel government will not have a part? They ask how we can speak of free elections when the Saigon press is censored and controlled by the military junta. And they are surely right to wonder what kind of new government we plan to help form without them, the only party in real touch with the peasants. They question our political goals, and they deny the reality of a peace settlement from which they will be excluded. Their questions are frighteningly relevant. Is our nation planning to build on political myth again and then show it up upon the power of new violence? Here is the true meaning and value of compassion and nonviolence when it helps us to see the enemy's point of view, to hear his questions, to know his assessment of ourselves. Far from his view, we may indeed see the basic weaknesses of our own condition, and if we are mature, we may learn and grow and profit from the wisdom of the brothers who are called the opposition. Here is the true meaning and value of compassion and nonviolence when it helps us to see the enemy's point of view, to hear his questions, to know his assessment of ourselves. Far from his view, we may indeed see the basic weaknesses of our own condition, and if we are mature, we may learn and grow and profit from the wisdom of the brothers who are called the opposition. So too with Hanoi, in the north, where our bombs now pummel the land and our mines endanger the waterways, we are met by deep but understandable mistrust. To speak for them is to explain this lack of confidence in Western words, and especially their distrust of American intentions now. In Hanoi are the men who led the nation to independence against the Japanese and the French, the men who sought membership in the French Commonwealth and were betrayed by the weakness of Paris and the willfulness of the colonial armies. It was they who led a second struggle against French domination at tremendous cost, and then were persuaded to give up the land they controlled between the 13th and 17th parallel as a temporary measure at Geneva.
This is not the Martin Luther King that you're used to. Not just civil rights. He's talking about the roots of the despair that the U.S. Carries on throughout the world. Martin Luther King got in some trouble for this, for diverging from his civil rights speech. This is not the Martin Luther King, the sanitized version that we have been taught about in our public schools.
After 1954, they watched us conspire with Diem to prevent elections which could have surely brought Ho Chi Minh to power over a united Vietnam. And they realized they had been betrayed again. When we ask why they do not leap to negotiate, these things must be remembered. Also, it must be clear that the leaders of Hanoi considered the presence of American troops in support of the Diem regime to have been the initial military breach of the Geneva agreements concerning foreign troops. And they remind us that they did not begin to send troops in large numbers and even supplies into the South until American forces had moved into the tens of thousands. Hanoi remembers how our leaders refused to tell us the truth about the earlier North Vietnamese overtures for peace, how the president claimed that none existed when they had clearly been made. Ho Chi Minh has watched as America has spoken of peace and built up its forces, and now he has surely heard the increasing international rumors of American plans for an invasion of the North. He knows the bombing and shelling and mining we are doing a part of traditional pre-invasion strategy. Perhaps only his sense of humor and of irony can save him when he hears the most powerful nation of the world speaking of aggression as it drops thousands of bombs on a poor, weak nation more than 8,000 miles away from its shores. At this point, I should make it clear that while I have tried in these last few minutes to give a voice to the voiceless in Vietnam, and to understand the arguments of those who are called enemy, I am as deeply concerned about our own troops there as anything else. For it occurs to me that what we are submitting them to in Vietnam is not simply the brutalizing process that goes on in any war where armies face each other and seek to destroy. We are adding cynicism to the process of death, for they must know after the short period there that none of the things we claim to be fighting for are really involved. Before long, they must know that their government has sent them into a struggle among Vietnamese. The more sophisticated surely realize that we are on the side of the wealthy and the secure while we create a hell for the poor. Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. I speak as a child of God and brother to the suffering poor of Vietnam. I speak for those whose land is being laid waste, whose homes are being destroyed, whose culture is being subverted. I speak for the poor of America who are paying the double price of smashed hopes at home and death and corruption in Vietnam. I speak as a citizen of the world, for the world as it stands aghast at the path we have taken. I speak as one who loves America, to the leaders of our own nation. The great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must be ours.